I'd like to tell you about a striking result in cognitive neuropsych, and I'd like to give you a little bit of a hint of the flavor of a really beautiful underlying mathematical system that we use to arrive at these results. And I guess one of the ideas that you've taken from Mark's talk earlier is an intimate relationship between internal trajectories in state space of the brain and external trajectories through space, three-dimensional space of the limbs. So thanks, Mark, for softening up the audience for me. So after a brief introduction, I'll describe our experiment, and then I'll describe very briefly geometric algebra, just hinting in the direction of a very deep and beautiful subject. And then I'll come back to the results that we obtained, which will hopefully be astounding. And
now we're ready.
And then we'll finish with a brief summary. So by way of introduction, let's ask, why do we bother to study measurements of hands through space? And the idea is that we want to be able to infer something about the processes that are going inside the brain, and we're interested in embodied cognition. That is to say, the abstract processes, the symbol processing that occurs by abstraction of the perception action cycle in the organism. So embodied cognition we view as being something very different from disembodied cognition of an AI in a computer. And we specifically are trying to distinguish between two viewpoints on reach to grasp, which we characterize as the perceptual viewpoint and the cognitive viewpoint. The perceptual viewpoint being that once emotion is initiated, once the go signal is given, the cognitive apparatus is off doing other stuff, and only perceptual feedback loops continue to modulate the motion. So if the object you're reaching for moves, then your eye tracks it and your hand adjusts its trajectory and so on. But things at the level of meaning no longer have any effect. Whereas the cognitive viewpoint says, no, the cognitive apparatus continues to be coupled in and continues to affect the trajectory right up throughout, right till the very end. So the perceptual viewpoint would expect the cognitive effects to be strongest at the beginning stages and decay to zero, perhaps all the way to zero, hopefully before you get to the end, so that perceptual feedback is all that's controlling the final stages and all that influences the grasp. Whereas in the cognitive viewpoint, you would expect the cognitive influences to continue throughout and modulate the actual final grasp. And that, in fact, is what we've been able to show. So people who study these kinds of things should now be astounded. So the whole idea is that in order to probe the structure and function of the system, we manipulate cognitive parameters and we measure the kinematic response parameters and infer the process in between. And the tools that are available for characterizing trajectories and their perturbations aren't really up to the task. So we had to develop some tools for doing this job and for performing statistical comparisons on trajectories. And I'm speaking now of three-dimensional physical trajectories through space. So let's look at the experiment that we set up to do this. Well, we start with some sensors, one on the wrist, one on the back of the hand. And these sensors are measuring position and orientation in space. So they're measuring all six parameters of the Euclidean motion group. Then we add, in this case, sensors on the two fingertips and the thumb tip, and what you end up with is a board. So what we see is in front of her is a device developed by Daniel Bubb and Mike Masson called the Graspasaurus, where a number of response elements can be arrayed in front of her. And she's now going to be asked to make reach-to-grasp movements in different cognitive states. And the first one we call the related state, where she's shown a picture of a beer mug and then asked to make a grasp which is compatible with picking up a beer mug. So the picture and the motion that she's asked to execute are related. And in this case, she would perform this kind of a motion. Now, in the unrelated case, she might still be shown a picture of a beer mug, but in this case, she would be asked to perform a horizontal grasp, the kind of thing that you would use to pick up a frying pan. So those are unrelated. Of course, the other two parts of the matrix are there too. I mean, she's going to be shown pictures of frying pans while being asked to do horizontal and closed grasps as well. So all four elements of that 2x2 matrix are there. But I'm only showing you one row of the matrix, if you like, because we're short on time. So and in that case, she would perform this kind of action. Now notice that it's always the hand picture that she's mimicking with her action. She's never asked to do any kind of a motor action in response to the picture. However, to make sure that she's attending to it, we ask her to name it. So she's asked to name the beer mug, but she's asked to mimic the hand gesture that she's shown. Yes? So what kind of data do we get out of an experiment like this? Well, we get trajectories through space of the fingertips, and they look like that. And there you can actually see her performing a horizontal grasp. I'm only showing the trajectories for the horizontal grasp, but you can imagine similar things for the closed grasp. Now here you can see the back of the hand and the wrist and moving. You can see the fingertips curling around as she performs the grasp. And this is one particular subject in the related condition, and then the same subject in the unrelated condition. And you can see there's a difference there. But how do we characterize that? How do we put some numbers on that and say, is this statistically significant? So that's, and is this the whole story? Well, in fact, it's not. It's only half the story. This only gives us X, Y, and Z, and we still have some rotational parameters to deal with. So how do we characterize those? Well, what we use is a thing called a quaternion, which you can think of as being an axis in space, and the length of the arrow indicates the amount of rotation about that axis. So if the axis stays fixed and the angle changes, the arrow will get longer and shorter. But if the axis changes, then that arrow would swing around. So during the course of the movement, this arrow is going to trace a trajectory through the interior of that sphere. Now, in reality, if you look over here in the corner, you can see that a quaternion really is a four-parameter object. It lives in a four-dimensional space, and indeed, the ones that represent rotations live on the surface of the three-sphere in four-dimensional space. But what we're doing is mapping that three-sphere into a three-dimensional volume so that we can visualize it. So this is not what they really look like, but it's a way of visualizing it that we can actually hold. And the trajectories that you see through the quaternion domain look like that. And again, we have the five sensors. These glitches down here are there for technical reasons, and they get removed before we do the analysis. But again, you can see that for the same subject changing between the related and unrelated condition, there are some differences between these trajectories. And once again, the question is, how do we characterize these differences, and are they significant? So here, what I've done is I've averaged all the traces for one subject in two different conditions, and what you don't see is the error ellipsoids, which are so small that the lines that I've used to draw the trajectories occlude the error ellipsoids. So we're actually getting very precise results here, a couple of millimeters. So the error ellipsoids are really small. And you can see that there are some differences in certain parts of the trajectories that are very significant. But that's just by eyeball. We don't know how significant, just by looking at it. And you see again, for another subject, the same comparison again yields differences of trajectories, but the differences from one subject to the next are huge compared to the tiny differences between one condition and the next within subjects. And to make matters worse, in this domain, the average of the differences is not equal to the difference of the averages. So we have to take differences and then average the differences across subjects. Now, when you take differences of vectors, that's pretty easy. You take the two vectors and you take the one that joins the two tips of the vectors, and that's the difference vector. But how do you do that in the quaternion domain? What's a difference quaternion? Oh, before I go on to that, I should point out that this little blob which has just appeared here is the difference now averaged over 9 subjects and drawn to scale of the whole motion. So this little thing here, and when I summarize it, when I come back to the results, we're going to blow this up and take a close look at what's going on in this little blob. But drawn to scale of the whole movement, you can see that the differences are quite small. So this is how we represent a difference of quaternions. The quaternions, remember, represent rotations. So the question is, how do we represent the difference between this quaternion and this quaternion? Well, that's a rotation, which is going to rotate the red one into the green one, and the axis of that rotation is going to be the blue one. So what you see is something like this. The quaternion, the red one, is rotated into the green one by rotating about the blue axis. And there, where we look at the trajectories now averaged within one subject, we can see that indeed again within subjects that there are differences between the two conditions. And in this case, we can see that the error volumes are quite a bit bigger. You can actually see them. But again, there are places where the trajectories are far enough apart that the error volumes don't overlap. So you have a statistically significant difference. And there again, we see one subject, the other subject. There are differences between conditions within each subject. But the differences between subjects, again, are large. So we need to get rid of those somehow. And there, again, drawn to scale, these are the trajectories swept out by the difference quaternions. And again, we're going to blow that up later on and take a look at how things look in there. Now, you'll notice I said error volumes. I didn't say error ellipsoids. In Euclidean space, what we see is a trivariate Gaussian distribution, which is going to give you an error ellipsoid. In other words, the probability distribution the probability mass that represents one standard error lives within an ellipsoidal volume. In quaternion domain, the shape of that volume is very different, and in fact, the shape changes depending on where in the sphere you are. And what you see is something like this. You notice that when it's near the origin, you get two lobes that stick out along the axis. And as it moves outwards, it gets squashed against the sphere. So that, of course, if the quaternion is it can't go outside that sphere. It's got to live inside the unit sphere. So now you get something that looks more like a mushroom cap splattered against the surface of the sphere. And so that's what the equivalent of the distribution looks like. The error volume, one standard error, looks like in the quaternion domain. Now I drew that standard error quite large so that we could all have a nice view of the volume, but the same concept applies. So, what is this geometric algebra? Well, it's a way of expressing the intrinsic relationships between geometric objects without introducing coordinates and all sorts of other things that really have nothing to do with geometry. So it gives us a very concise and clear problem representation, which leads to improved geometric insight. It, we have less parameters. A quaternion has four parameters and one constraint leading to a three-dimensional thing, whereas a rotation matrix has nine parameters. And so you have, and of course, it still has the same number of degrees of freedom in the end. So you've got a lot more computation to do to get the same kinds of results. So using this approach, you get a big improvement, and the improvement gets better as you go up in dimensionality. And so in addition to conceptual efficiency and geometric insight, we get conceptual transparency. It's easy to look at a quaternion and see that there's a rotation happening about a certain axis, and the length of the arrow indicates how much rotation is going on. Just try getting that same insight by looking at a rotation matrix. Another nice thing about geometric algebra is that one unified formalism includes Gibbs vector algebra, Cartan's differential forms, Dirac spinners, Penrose twisters. The number of different geometric objects that are all representable in a uniform framework is uncanny. We get complex numbers, quaternions, octonions, all live in this same representational formalism. Not only that, but the transformations that we use are all unified. Linear transformations, projective transformations, Mobius transformations, all of them can be represented with the same symbols. And as I said before, we have a completely coordinate-free representation. So the representations are inherently covariant. Once we prove something in one coordinate system, we don't have to additionally prove that there was nothing special about that coordinate system and that all the results would have been the same in any other coordinate system that we chose. We don't use coordinates. We use the algebraic relationships between the geometric objects themselves, the intrinsic relationships. So it's inherently covariant. And that means there are no coordinate singularities, like the convergence of lines at the poles of a sphere, for example. It homogenizes the space. In other words, we don't have to treat the origin as special. It's built right into the formalism that no one cares where the origin is. Nothing is dependent on where we choose our origin. The origin is just moved out of the space that we're representing. And what's moved into the space that we're representing is an explicit representation of infinity. Now, this is very important because it compactifies the space. By adding the point at infinity, we can unify what we call flats and rounds. Flats are lines, planes, and things like that. Rounds are circles and spheres and things like that. And if you think about it, a line is just a circle of infinite radius that goes through the point at infinity. So having an explicit representation of the point at infinity allows us to represent lines and planes and circles and spheres all with the same constructs. And that means that we can handle translations and rotations in a uniform way. They have I'll show that in a little more detail later. And that turns all rigid body motions into orthogonal transformations, which are among the easiest transformations to work with. So so many technical problems are just swept aside when we work with geometric algebra. It's beautiful. But I'll just give you one more little hint about it. Is we use it to represent what's called a screw transformation. And any rigid body motion through space can be represented as a movement along a line and simultaneously a twist in a plane that's at right angles to that line. We call that, because it's a screw-like motion, we call it a screw transformation. Any physical motion of a body that doesn't cause it to stretch or tear can be represented as such a motion. And here you see that the part that represents the rotation is just another one of these quaternions that we looked at earlier. And the part that represents the translation looks exactly the same, except it involves this point at infinity. So you can treat translations and rotations with exactly the same algebraic techniques, except that one of them happens to include the point at infinity and the other one doesn't. So that's as deep as I'm going to get into geometric algebra. I would love to spend the rest of the day talking about it, but they won't let me. So let's go back and look at the results that we got. Well, first of all, let's look at what we would see if there were no results. Here we see a condition where there are no results. And of course, if you imagine two trajectories that go through space without being different at all, ever, the vector that can the line that joins the two endpoints would be zero length for all time. In other words, if there was no difference between these two trajectories, we would see a point that sits at the origin. Well, of course, our measurements have noise on them, so what we see is a point that wanders around in the vicinity of the origin. And what we mean by the vicinity of the origin is that the errors, the error volumes, or in this case, actual error ellipsoids, are large enough that the trajectory never moves so far away from the origin that the origin is outside the error ellipsoid. As long as the origin remains inside the error ellipsoid, there's nothing statistically significant going on. However, this is what we actually see. What we see is that now this is the trajectory. The gold trajectory is the trajectory of the index finger, and the red one is the trajectory of the thumb. I've just pulled out two of the trajectories to make it easier to look at. And what we see here is that the motion starts out, indeed, at the origin, because every trial starts out with the subject's hand in the same position. So there's going to be no difference at the very beginning of the motion. But as the motion progresses, you see that the origin is no longer inside that error volume. And indeed, somewhere around the middle of the motion, the origin is far away from the error volume, many standard errors away. This is not just a barely significant result. This is a dramatic result. I mean, we've got five or six, or out here maybe even eight or nine standard errors. That's huge. And what's even more significant is that we see that in the resting positions, the end where the grip is complete, you actually see that we're still a few standard errors away from the origin. So what we see here is that the influence, now remember, what we're plotting here is the unrelated versus the related condition. Nothing has changed except the object that the subject is holding in her mind and is asked to name but isn't asked to do anything with. So there we see that clearly that the cognitive state is affecting the trajectory throughout its entire motion, and indeed the effect continues to modulate the final grasp even once the reach to grasp motion is finished. So you even end up, not only is the trajectory do the reach differently, but you end up in a different position. And if you look at this figure carefully, what you see is that what's going on is that remember this is a horizontal grasp that's being executed. And what you see is that the index finger is coming up a little bit, and the thumb is coming out a little bit. So it's like thinking about the beer mug makes the hand want to rear up into the position needed to execute the grasp afforded by the beer mug. And this entirely contradicts the perceptual viewpoint on how these things work. It shows that the cognitive state has a significant effect right to the beginning, and in fact, it's the effect that you would expect. Yes. Yes. She sees the beer mug first. 300 milliseconds.
Twenty-five percent of the time, we say, "What did you just see?" She says, "I saw a beer mug."
Okay,
that's it. Okay. It's as simple as that.
So I don't know if you can answer this with your paradigm, and maybe we can keep talking about it later. But it seems like you're making a claim that there's an effect of the representation of the beer mug all throughout until the end, because
yes,
the trajectories are different.
Yes.
Is it possible that the trajectories are different, or the positions are different at the end because of some difference in the starting point, and that the cognitive representation does not have an effect later? It's just
definitely
that. Okay, why is that?
You can see See, this green point here is the origin. If there were no significant difference throughout the trajectory, the point would remain at the origin. So you see that at the beginning, there is no statistical difference. So it's not due to differences at the beginning.
Right. But at the, let's say, at some midpoint. So there's an effect. Okay. Yeah, I see you nodding. Maybe you can rephrase this better than me. But it seems like we know that the positions are different. So the trajectories differ throughout.
They start at the same position. So what you see...
Right, so there's an effect early on, right?
No, there's no effect early on.
It grows with time, but does not decay to zero, as you would expect with the perceptual viewpoint.
Sorry, the starting point is...
Precisely. It has to start...
It could be an initial produces the resulting trajectory.
What we're saying is not that there's no initial effect. What we're saying is that the effect doesn't decay away, that the cognitive state continues to modulate right till the end.
If you put something into the initial state of a dynamic system, it has the possibility of persisting.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. But the consensus of people who do research in this area at this point seems to be that No, by the time you actually get to the grasp, only very low-level volumetric and positional, stuff on the retina is affecting your trajectory. Then cognitive stuff has all decayed away by that point. That's what's currently thought. And what we've shown here is, no, that's not the case.
I guess those people aren't in the room.
No, they aren't. And when we look at the quaternion side of the equation, we see the same thing. We see that the error volumes look a lot different again, but at the end of the trajectory, there still survives a significant difference. And then here is what we see exaggerated in the related condition. The hand just comes down into a standard grasp. And in the unrelated condition, a little bit of the other grasp, which the subject is never asked to perform, only to name the object. But that object is still exerting some kind of a virtual force to pull the hand up into the possible contingency that perhaps you'll have to grab it. So this change of postures here is exaggerated from the figures that we saw earlier. But to make the visualization easier. So,
is it equal in both directions?
Pardon me?
So, if they need to grasp.
Oh, yes, the other one is there. I just didn't have time to go.
No, but is it equally?
It's equally dramatic.
More effect to the beer.
Yes. Yes, it's not just the reinforcing effect of beer. So, just to quickly summarize, we've used this uniquely powerful formalism called conformal geometric algebra, which gives us that compactification and that homogenization of the representational space, unifies translation and rotation, and linearizes our error propagation calculations. And these are key things, because we're using products called the geometric product, which is kind of a weird sum of a dot product and a different kind of product that together make a product that you can actually invert. You can actually divide by vectors in this formalism. It's beautiful. It's absolutely gorgeous. And so because of that, because we can divide by vectors, we can divide by planes, we can divide by volumes, we can do all kinds of stuff that is normally done using iterative nonlinear algorithms, and we can just do it like that, just by dividing by something. So using this formalism, we've characterized these trajectories in their perturbations, and we've performed the statistical hypothesis tests on them, showing clearly many, many standard deviations of difference. So what we've shown then is that the cognitive influences persist throughout the act of reaching and grasping. They do not decay. They're not strongest at the early stages. And the perturbation persists into the final grasp itself. These are the key elements of the results that we've demonstrated. Um, and by way of interpretation, we can consider that cognitive influences act like virtual force fields, so that the organism's need to perform its motions efficiently is going to pull towards the real grasp that's being executed. But the cognitive state, the contingency that something, I'm thinking about this beer mug for a reason, and the motor system, of course, doesn't know what that reason is. But so there's some contingency there, and this contingency pulls towards the virtual grasp. And so the actual trajectory of the hand through space integrates these two forces pulling in opposite directions. And remember the one force is created simply by bearing in mind a beer mug, because you might have to name it. And so this creates a resulting trough in the state space of the internal network, and the resulting trajectory runs down that trough. And so we can think of the cognitive state then as creating a virtual force field that affects the motion of the hand through space. I guess that's my way of saying I hope I haven't spent too much of this talk talking about things that interest only me.
Okay, more questions?
So, say,
thank you.
So, say I'm going to reach for, you tell me to make the frying pan reach.
Okay. We call that a horizontal grasp.
I'll call it the frying pan reach.
Fair enough.
And I make some motor plan, which, let's say is either, in the language for my talk, some initial state in state space, or in Emo's language, some control policy. And that initial state or that control policy, when you then force me to keep something in mind that's incompatible with the frying pan, i.e. you force me to remember, you don't just show it to me, you force me to remember.
That's right.
That it tugs that control policy or that initial state 2% in the direction of that other motor plan or that other control policy.
Yep.
Then you set the whole thing in motion. You get some, frankly, very small difference in the trajectory.
Yes.
Is that all? I mean, is that to you trivializing what you found, or is that a completely satisfying explanation for what you found?
Well, what it tells me is that you have the same viewpoint on it as I do, is that you look at this result and say, of course that's what you'd expect.
Yeah.
And so that's why I found it so amazing that the consensus of the cognitive psych literature in the area says, no, that's not the way it works.
Okay.
So what I find surprising is not this result, but the result we've disproved.
But who cares what cognitive psych people say about motor control?
I only care about the geometric algebra.
Okay.
Oh, hello. So what about Lawrence Barcelo? Do you know him? So his point, I think he talks to the cognitive scientist, psychologist guys, and his point is that he talks about, criticizes amodal representations. The idea that we have representations, cognitive representations, that have nothing to do with the sensory motor things. And you have a real good example that to hold a cognitive idea in your head, it influences your motor behavior.
Yes.
Okay. So he's isn't aren't you? So it seems to me you're making his point.
Yes.
Okay. And so
I didn't say ever.
I don't know. There are at least some psychologists that accept this or that and are arguing for this, and it's. They would say it's ordinary too, or it's consistent with his
view. I guess
view.
I'm thinking primarily of Mel Goodale and his people, who have a large body of literature published that say, well, whether you have amodal representations or not, we're not going to speak to that. But whatever representations there are, once you give the go signal, the trajectory after that is ballistic, with the exception of low-level perceptual inputs. That's the claim, and that's the claim that we've disproved.
Okay, just a comment. This kind of reminds me of the McGurk effect in speech. All right.
I'm not familiar with it.
You're not. Okay, so you show a picture of a mouth position, but the person is supposed to actually say a different phoneme.
Okay.
And you get something in the middle.
Okay.
So basically, that's a simple way of describing it, that you're influenced by the visual, and the visual actually has a very major effect on what you what you're being told auditorily to do. So you're looking at a picture of a person going for ba, okay? Uh-huh. You're listening to the command, say da,
yeah,
and you're actually very much influenced by the
and
picture.
You end up producing something in between. That is...
It is perceptual. Well, it is perceptual, but in the visual. Visual, auditory, perception. But you still have
you
to...
hear something, you see something.
Yeah, but it also works...
Something different.
Yeah, I think that's...
But it also works with saying it.
But this is like an inhibition.
In what way?
Well, on those tasks where there's go, no-go, or whatever you call them, where you see one thing and you have to inhibit and do something else. And it seems to me that you're doing something similar here. And so one of the questions I had, and it's because I can't see the thing, is the timing of the two. One might expect, for example, that where you have an unrelated picture and you're asked to do something else with a grasp, that the timing of the grasp might be slightly different.
Actually, yes, you do see timing differences.
And what are they?
Let me remember.
You're slower. I would think you'd slower. Be slower on the unrelated, right?
Yeah. That's right. And what you see is you actually see it takes longer to initiate the action, and the trajectory itself moves a little more slowly. But the trajectories that I plotted here are all normalized time. So the time is plotted 0 to 100% from the point that the motion started to the point that the motion stopped. So that's factored out. But yes, that effect exists as well. Yes.
If you had some novel object and you had to make some strange grasp that you're not typically making when you would grab a beer mug, or would you expect then to sort of revert back to using perceptual mechanisms, or?
I would expect this effect to be initially not present, but as you learn the affordances of this novel object, I would expect the effect to become increasingly strong. It's an interesting experiment that we haven't mm-hmm. run, that we've actually been thinking about running. But that's what I would expect anyway.
Do you envision any technological application for this, like for distinguish the intentions of a person in like a virtual reality or?
Well, I can think of all kinds of uses for the mathematical techniques.
Yeah.
I mean, here they were used to prove a point in cognitive psychology, but you could just as easily use them, because they're quite precise, you could use them for diagnostic purposes in, dyskinesias, Parkinson's, all kinds of movement disorders, for gait analysis, on and on it goes.
Rotations?
Yeah. The hand, of course, is an articulated rigid body, so you've got multi-joint effects going on there. In that case, what you have to do, of course, is propagate the errors down the kinematic chain. And that requires doing convolutions in the Euclidean motion group domain, which is greatly simplified by geometric algebra.
I just want to say one more thing, because I'm thinking of the guy on the left there asking what it means in layman's terms. I think what you're showing is that there's crosstalk between what you're thinking about and what you're doing.
Correct. And that, as I say, that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
What surprises me is that it contradicts much of the literature in the area.
Me too.
Yeah.
let me ask a question.
Yes.
So I love quaternions and geometry. In fact, I use quaternions every day.
My kind of guy.
I used to sort of like cognitive neuroscience. I even have a PhD in it. I have absolutely no idea what these two things have to do with each other. I mean, you made some very interesting points about motor control and cognitive neuroscience. You described the experiments. You may have noticed that you did not get a single question slash comment about the math. It was all about the experiments.
Yeah.
The experiments could be described without the math. They did not, as far as I understand, the math did not give you any insight that you couldn't have gotten just by plotting the trajectory. The main plot that you showed was really a trajectory in space, and then you showed something.
Actually, what I showed was both sides of the story.
Right. You showed the other one too, but it looked like we could have skipped the other one and get exactly the same scientific insight into the experiment.
Well, so you would only get half the story.
Well,
the Euclidean motion group is a six-parameter group. Showing only the trajectories shows you, okay, in three of the six parameters, there's a statistically significant difference. And by using the quaternions, you can show that, indeed, in all six parameters, there's a difference. Now, you could do the same thing with rotation matrices.
But indeed, there are 30 parameters, because, as you pointed out, the hand is complicated. So even the six-dimensional space doesn't show. But the point is more general. I mean,
a six-dimensional space for each digit, for each endpoint.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the more general point I'm making is, what's the point of using math when you can say the same thing without it?
Well, you can.
Tell us about it.
And I could ask the same question for many of the talks that I have given over the years. I should point out.
How can you possibly demonstrate statistical significance without doing the math?
Just a second. Let me answer. Are you saying that... Not your hero, but I have to answer. Are you telling me that what we've been doing since before we could do this, all we had is transport time, the time to move, get your hand up, move through space, land on the element? Are you telling me that we didn't show anything more than what we would have done just using transport time?
No, at all. You've done great experiments. What I'm telling you is that if the world Quaternion and conformal algebra were not the findings would be exactly the same. You could do statistics directly in the data space, whatever that was, and it would be just as convincing, and people would be just as excited. That's all I'm saying. Yes, please, go ahead.
I think that's a vacuous point, frankly. I think there's no content in that. Because the whole point is that the error calculations in this formalism are linear. Because all you're using is bilinear products. You're not doing anything fancy.
Right, but if you look at the joint space of the hand, they're not linear anymore. So,
well, yes, they are in this formalism.
Yeah.
All right.
Donnie?
You're living in a world which was constructed by Gibbs and Heaviside. So all the matrix vector algebra that we use is entirely contingent on a debate that happened at the end of the 19th century between them on one side and Grassmann, Maxwell, and Hamilton on the other side.
And that's even less relevant than quaternions.
Otherwise, we would all be doing quaternions and Clifford algebras and all the things he's talking about, and not this godforsaken matrix algebra where you have to represent rotations with, like, too many numbers, right? So what he's saying is that if the natural way to represent the thing that you're talking about is in this different space, and you got all these nice properties, and that correlates to something that you measure in an experiment in the shapes of error surfaces and stuff like that, then it's correct. And the fact is, I mean, I got really into these Clifford algebras for a couple of years as well, because I wanted to make like Clifford ICA and things like that, because you can divide vectors by vectors, you can do all kinds of things that you can't do in linear algebra.
You just can't do vector algebra, and
natural gradient, all this Amari stuff, and all these new Hessians and Fisher information matrices, they'll all turn into different objects in this space. We should rewrite the whole of machine learning in geometric algebra, and then you would know exactly the answer to your question.
I agree with everything you said, but it does not relate to my question. Yes, we're talking about cognitive neuroscience and motor control and how the brain works. Of course, we should do rotations with quaternions, and like I said, I mean, I've been writing software for the last 3 years doing exactly that, and it works really well. It's not really how the brain works; it's just software.
So you've just made my point for me.
No, really.
Well, yeah. So
going really well. But it doesn't make it any harder than it has to be.
It doesn't explain how the brain works.
Yeah. So going back to the cognitive neuroscience, you said that we should expect that the affordances of the beer mug, And that ties in. So my question is, why do we expect that this result should be there? I mean, and exactly why? And of course, the interesting current in embodied cognition and in neuroscience is that objects, knowledge of objects, memory of objects, retrieval of memory of objects, identification and classification, in other words, all our cognitive interactions with objects are very much tied in with these motor affordances.
Yes.
So that a beer mug is something that is to be grasped. Yeah, and so that is something that with a clean formalism, you could by expanding, generalizing the experiment, actually chart these sort of affordances, not just a conventional beer mug, but you could have all sorts of, you could learn the space of representations of objects.
Right, you absolutely could.